Part 2, Chapter 7. I'm lying in the dark in a strange, strong-smelling bed. Not far above my face is a ceiling, a low vault of raw black rock. Beside me lies something warm, pressing heavily against my leg. It raises its head, a long, gray head, grim black lips, dark eyes that gaze across me. A dog? A wolf? I remember this many times. Remembered waking up with the dog or wolf pressed close beside me, lying among rank-smelling furs in the dark place with a rock ceiling. A cave, it must be. I remember it now. I'm lying there now. The dog gives a whining groan and gets up, steps over me. Someone speaks to it, then comes and crouches beside me and speaks to me, but I don't understand what he says. I don't know who he is, who I am. I can't lift my head. I can't lift my hand. I'm weak, empty, nothing. I remember nothing. I'll tell you what happened in the order it happened, as historians do. But there's deep untruth in doing so. I didn't live my life as history is written. My mind used to leap ahead, remembering what hadn't yet come to pass. Now, what was past was lost to me. What I tell you now, it took me a long time to find again. Memory hid from me and buried itself in darkness as I lay buried in that dark place, that cave. It was early in the morning, in the first warmth of spring. The open inner courtyards of Archimonde were cheerful in the sunlight.
"Where's Sallow?" "Oh, Sallow and Rhys both went off with Torm D, Gav."
"With Torm D?"
"Yes. He took them off to the Hotwells last night, pretty late."
Folly was talking to me. Folly was the gate guard to the silk rooms. She sat in the western court with her spinning, a heavy, slow-spoken woman, who had long ago been one of the father's gift girls. She made a reverence whenever she spoke of the father or the mother or any of the family or any other well-born family. She worshipped them as gods. People used to laugh at her for it.
"Folly thinks they're already ancestors," Ymir said.
Folly was a foolish woman. What foolish thing had she just said, bobbing her head when she said Torm D? That Torm had taken Rhys and my sister to the Hotwells? The Hotwells belonged to Coric Runda, son of the senator, Granok Runda, the wealthiest and most powerful man in the government of Etra. Coric had wanted to marry our Astano and failed, but seemingly he held no grudge. Lately he'd become Torm's friend, or patron. Torm was always with him in his circle of young, rich men. Young, rich men could live the high life, now that Etra was free and prosperous again. Endless feasts, women, drinking parties that ended up as riots in the city streets. A strange friendship for Torm, it seemed to some of us, with his stiff, grim ways and his warrior's training. But Coric had taken a fancy to him, insisted on having him. And the father approved of the friendship, encouraging it as a good thing for the family, for the Arca interest with the House of Runda. Young men would be young men. There would be women and drinking and so on. There was no harm in it. Nothing would go really wrong. Tib, apprentice cook now, followed Hobie about like a dog when Hobie was at Archimonde, and Tib told us the stories Hobie told him. Coric and his friends liked to get Torm drunk because he went crazy when he was drunk and would do anything they dared him to do. fence with 3 men at once, fight a bear, tear off his clothes and dance naked on the Senate steps till he fell down in a foaming fit. They thought Torm was wonderful, Hobie said. They all admired him. To some of us, it sounded as if they used him as a clown, for entertainment, like the dwarfs Korik kept as wrestlers, or his half-witted, one-eyed, giant bodyguard, Hearn. But it wasn't like that at all, according to Hobie, as related by Tib. Hobie said that Korik Runda took lessons in sword fighting from Torm, treating him as a master of the art. He said all Korik's friends respected Torm. They feared his great strength. They liked him to run wild because then everybody feared him and them.
Torm D is young, Evera said. Let him have his fling while he's young. He'll be the wiser for it when he's older. The father knows that. He had his wild days, too.
The Runda estate called the Hotwells was a mile or so from Etra in the rich grain lands west of the city. The senator built a grand new house there and gave it to his son Korik. Hobie told Tib all about it, and Tib told us. The luxurious chambers, the silk rooms full of women, the courts full of flowers, and the wonderful bathing pool in a back court. The water came up from a hot spring and was always the temperature of blood, but it was transparent blue-green, and peacocks spread their plumage beside it on pavements of green and purple marble. Hobie had been there many times as Torm's bodyguard. All these young noblemen had bodyguards. It was the fashion. Korik had 3 besides the giant. Torm had bought a 2nd one recently. The bodyguards were invited to share the women in the silk rooms at the Hotwells, to take their pick of the food and the women, after their masters, of course. Hobie had swum in the warm pool. He told Tib all about the pool, about the women, about the food, minced livers of capon, the tongues of unborn lambs. So, when Folly said to me that Torm had taken Rhys and Sallow to the Hotwells, though my mind seemed blank as if I'd run into a stone wall and been stunned, I went after a little while to the kitchens and looked for Tib. I thought he might know something from Hobie. I don't know what I thought he might know. He knew nothing. When I told him what Folly had said, he looked taken aback for a moment, dismayed. Then he said, "There are a lot of women there. The Rundas keep dozens of slave women there. Torm just took the girls there to have a good time." I don't know what I answered, but it made Tib go sullen and defensive. "Look, Gav, maybe your teacher's pet and all, but remember, after all, Sal and Rhys are gift girls." "They weren't given to Torm," I said. I spoke slowly because my mind was still blank and slow. "Rhys is a virgin. Sallow was given to Yavin. Torm can't take them out of the house. He can't have taken them there. The mother would never allow it." Tib shrugged. "Maybe Folly got the story mixed up," he said, and turned away to his work. I went to Ymir and told her what Folly said. I repeated what I'd said to Tib, that it couldn't be. The mother wouldn't allow it. Ymir, who, like so many people since the siege, now looked much older than she was, said nothing at all for a while. Then only a great "ah," and shook her head again and again. "Oh, this is not good," she said. I hope Folly is wrong. She must be. How could she let him take off the girls without permission? I'll speak with her. And with other women in the silk rooms. Oh, Sallow." She had always loved my sister, best of all the girls. "No, it can't be," she said with more energy. "Of course, you're right. Mother Falamer Io wouldn't allow it, never. Yavendiz Sallow and little Rhys?
No, no, no. That suet-headed folly has got something mixed up. I'll go get this straight right now. I was used to trusting Ymir, who generally did get things straight. I went off to the schoolroom and put my young pupils through their drills and recitations. I kept my mind from thinking until the morning was over. I went to the refectory. People were talking, a group of them, men and women. No, Tan was saying. I put the horses in myself. He took them off in the closed car with Hobi and that lout he bought from the Rundas in with them, and himself driving the horses. Well, if the mother let them go, there's no harm in it, Enumer said in her high, vague voice. Of course the mother let them go, said another woman, but Tan, who was second hostler now, shook his head and said, They were bundled up like a lot of washing in sacks. I didn't know who they were, even, till Sallow pokes out her head and tries to shout out something. Then Hobi pushes her back into the car like a sack of meal and bang goes the door, and off they go at a gallop. A prank-like, one of the older men said. A prank that'll get Sonny D and Twinny into some trouble with Daddy D, maybe, Tan said savagely. He saw me then, his dark eyes locked on mine. Gav, he said. You know anything about it? Did Sallow talk to you? I shook my head. I couldn't speak. Ah, it'll be all right, Tan said after a moment. A prank, like Uncle said. A damn fool, stupid joke. They'll be back this evening. I stood there with the others, but it was as if everything and everyone moved away from me, and I stood alone in a place where there was nothing and no one. I moved through the halls and courts of Archimonde with an emptiness around me. Voices came to me from a distance. The emptiness closed in and became dark, a low, rough roof of black stone, a cave. I know things, Sallow said to me. And I know them. We marsh people, we have our powers. And she laughed. Her bright eyes shone. I knew she was dead before they sent for me, before Avera told me. They thought it proper that Avera should be the one to tell me. An accident. Last night, in the pool at the Hot Wells. A sad accident, a terrible thing, Avera said, tears in his eyes. An accident, I said. He said Sallow had been drowned. Had drowned, he corrected himself, had drowned, as the young men, who had drunk too much and gone past all decency, were playing with the girls in the pool. The pool of warm water, I said, where there are peacocks on the marble. Yes, my teacher said, looking up at me with tear-wet eyes. He seemed to me to have a sly, cringing expression, as if he was ashamed of himself for doing something he shouldn't have done but would not confess, like a schoolboy. Rhys is home, he said, with the women in the silk rooms. She's in a lamentable state, poor girl. Not injured, but... It was madness, madness. We know that Tormdi has always had this frenzy that comes upon him, but to take the girls out of the house, to take them there among those men, madness, madness. Oh, the shame, the shame! The pity of it! Oh, my poor Gevir! And my teacher bowed his gray head before me, hiding his wet eyes and cringing face. And what will Yavendi say? He cried. I went through the halls, past the room of the ancestors, to the library, and sat there a while alone. The emptiness was around me, the silence. I asked Sallow to come to me, but no one came. "Sister," I said aloud. But I couldn't hear my voice. Then I thought, and it was perfectly clear to me, that if she had been drowned, she would be lying on the floor of the pool of green water warm as blood. If she wasn't there, where was she? She couldn't be there, so she couldn't have been drowned. I went looking for her. I went to the silk rooms, to the Western Court. I said to women I met there, "I'm looking for my sister." I had forgotten who the women were, the people that took me to her. But I knew her. She was lying among white cloths that covered her up. Her face, which was all I could see, was not rosy brown but grayish, with a dark bruise across one cheek. Her eyes were closed and she looked small and tired. I knelt beside her, and they let me be there. I remember that they came and said, "The mother has sent for you, Gevier," as if this was a solemn, important thing. I kissed Sallow and told her I'd be back soon. I went with them. They took me through the familiar corridors to the mother's apartments, which I knew only from outside. Sallow was allowed in to sweep the mother's rooms, but not I. I only swept the hallways there. She was waiting for me, tall in her long robes, the mother of Archimonde. "We are so sorry, Gevier, for your sister's death," she said in her beautiful voice. "Such a tragic accident. Such a sweet girl. I don't know how I'm ever to tell my son, Yavin. It will be a bitter grief to him. I know you loved your sister. I loved her too. I hope the knowledge of that will be some comfort to you. And this." She put into my hands a small, heavy pouch of silk. "I will send my own women to her funeral," she said, gazing earnestly at me. "Our hearts are broken for our sweet Sallow." I reverenced her and stood there. The people came and took me away again. They wouldn't take me back to Sallow. I never saw her face again, so I had to remember it grayish, bruised and tired. I didn't want to remember it that way. So I turned away from the memory. I forgot it. They took me back to my teacher, but he didn't want me, nor I him. As soon as I saw him, words broke out of me. "Will they punish Torm? Will they punish him?" Evera started back as if afraid of me. "Be calm, Gevier, be calm," he said placatingly. "Will they punish him? For the death of a slave girl?" Around his words, silence spread out. Silence enlarged around me, wider and deeper. I was in a pool, at the bottom of a pool, not of water, but of silence and emptiness, and it went on to the end of the world. I couldn't breathe the air, but I breathed that emptiness. Evera was talking. I saw his mouth opened and shut, his eyes glistened, an old gray-haired man opening and shutting his mouth. I turned away. There was a wall across my mind. On the other side of the wall was what I couldn't remember because it hadn't happened. I'd never been able to forget, but now I could. I could forget days, nights, weeks. I could forget people. I could forget everything I'd lost. Because I'd never had it. but I remember the burial ground when I stand there. Very early the next morning, just as day lightens the sky, I remember it because I've remembered it before. When we buried old Gemmy, when we buried little Miv, I remember standing there in the green rain of the willows, just outside the walls by the river, and wondering who we were burying on this other morning. It must be someone important, for all the mother's personal serving women are there in their white mourning garments, hiding their faces in their long shawls, and the body is wrapped in beautiful white silk, and Ymir is weeping aloud. She can't say the prayer to Enume. When she tries to, she makes a shrieking wail that tears a horrible, raw hole in the silence, so that now other women, weeping too, have gone to her to hold and console her. I stand near the water and watch how it eats at the riverbank, lapping and gnawing at the earth, undercutting the bank, eating away at it, so that the grass overhangs it, the white roots of the grass dangling down into the air above the water. If you looked in the earth of the bank, you'd find white bones, thin as roots, bones of little children buried there, where the water would come and eat their graves. A woman stood not far from me, not with the other women. A long ragged shawl was pulled over her head and hid her face, but she looked at me once. It was Sotor. I know that. I remember for a little while. When she and the other women were gone, there were some people around me, men, and I asked them if I could stay there in the cemetery. One of them was Tan, the stableman, who was kind to me when we were boys. He was kind to me then. He put his hand on my shoulder. "You'll be back in a bit then." I nodded. His lips were pinched together to keep from trembling. He said, "She was the sweetest girl I ever knew, Gav." He went off with the others. There was nobody in the cemetery now. They had put the green sod back over the grave as well as they could so that it hardly showed among all the other graves. But it didn't matter, since the river would wash all the graves away and there would be nothing left but a few white rags twisting in the current going to the sea. I walked away from the grave, upstream along the Nisos, under the willows. The way narrowed to a path between the city wall and the river, and then I was at the river gate. I waited for the market traffic coming into the city across the bridge to pass, heavy wagons drawn by white oxen, little carts pulled by a donkey or by a slave. At last there was a space among them so I could cross the roadway. I went on up the west bank of the Nisos. The path was pleasant, wandering nearer and farther from the riverbank, passing the small gardens that thrifty freemen planted and tended. Some old men were already in their plots, hoeing, weeding, enjoying the mild spring morning, the cloudy sunrise. I walked on, into the silence, the empty world. I walked under a low ceiling of raw black rock into the dark. There is much I'll never remember of the days after that day. When at last I learned forgetting, I learned it very quickly and all too well. What fragments I can find of those days may be memories or may not. They may be the other kind of remembering that I do, of times that haven't come and places I haven't yet been. I lived where I was and where I was not, all those days, all that time, a month, 2 months. I wasn't walking away from Archimonde because there was nothing behind me but a wall. and I'd forgotten most of what lay on the other side of it. There was nothing ahead of me at all. I walked. Who walked with me? Ennu, who guides us in death? Or Luck, who is deaf in the ear you pray to? The way took me. If there was a path, I followed it. If there was a bridge, I crossed it. If there was a village and I smelled food and was hungry, I went and bought food. In my pocket, ever since it was given to me, I had carried the little silk purse as full and heavy with money as a heart is full and heavy with blood. 6 silver pieces, 8 eagles, 20 half bronzes, 9 quarter bronzes. I counted them first as I sat by the Nisos, hidden among flowering shrubs and high grass. In the villages, I spent only the quarter bronzes. Even they were more than many people could change. Villagers and farmers gave me extra food when they couldn't give me pennies. Few people grudged me food, and some would rather give it than sell it to me. I wore white, the white of mourning, and I spoke as educated men of the city speak, and when they said, "Where are you going, Dee?" I said, "I am going to bury my sister." "Poor boy," I heard women say. Sometimes little children ran after me, shouting, "Crazy! Crazy!" But they never came close to me. I wasn't robbed by the poor people I went among, because I had no thought of being robbed, no fear of it. If I'd been robbed, it wouldn't have mattered to me at all. When you have nothing to pray for, that's when luck hears you. If Archimond had sought their runaway slave then, they would have found me easily enough. I didn't hide. Anyone along the Nisos could have put them on my trail. Probably at Archimond they said to one another that Gavir had drowned himself that morning at the slave cemetery after the others left, that he'd taken a heavy stone in his arms and walked out into the river. Instead, I took the mother's silken purse, heavy with money because it was in my pocket, and walked out into the empty world, because it didn't occur to me to take a stone and walk into the river. It didn't matter where I walked. The ways were all the same. There was only one way I couldn't go, and that was back. I crossed the Nisos somewhere. The little roads between villages took me round and about one direction then another. One day I saw the heads of high, round, green hills ahead of me. I had wandered onto the Ventin Road. If I kept on it, that road would take me up into the hills, to the farm, to Sentas. Those names and places came to me out of the forgetting. I remembered Sentas, the farm. I remembered someone who lived there. The farm slave, Comey. I sat down in the shade of an oak and ate some bread someone had given me. Thinking was a slow business for me then. It took a long time. Comey had been a friend. I thought I could go up to the farm and stay there. All the house slaves knew me. They'd treat me well. Comey would fish with me. Maybe the farm had been burned to the ground when Kasikar invaded, the orchards hacked down, the vines torn out. Maybe I could live in Sentas, as if it were a real place. All the slow, stupid thoughts went by, and I got up and turned my back on the road to Vente. I walked between two fields on a lane that went northeast. The lane took me to a road, narrow and rutted, with very few people on it. It kept going, leading away from things I remembered and wanted to forget, and I kept going on it. There was a town where I bought food in the market, enough for several days, and bought a rough brown blanket I could use for a bed at night. Later there was a desolate village where the dogs came out and barked and kept me from stopping there. but there was nothing to stop for. After that village, the road dwindled to a footpath. No crops were planted on the rolling hills. Sheep grazed, scattered out on the slopes, and their tall gray guard dog would stand up and watch me as I passed. Trees grew thick in the dales between the hills. I slept in those groves, drinking from the small streams that ran down among them. When I had no more food, for a while I looked for something to eat. It was too early for anything but a few tiny strawberries, and I didn't know what to look for. I gave up looking, and went on walking up the path between the hills. Hunger is painful. There was a thought in my head, not a memory, only a thought, that while I ate so well with the priests of the shrine, there was someone who had not had enough to eat, so that the baby starved in her womb, and so now it was my turn to go hungry. It was only fair. The distance I walked each day got shorter. I sat down often in the hot sunshine among the wild grasses. The flowering grasses were beautiful in their diversity. I would watch the little flies and bees in the air, or remember what had happened or not happened, as if it were all one dream. The day would pass, the sun would pass on its great path across the sky, before I got up and trudged on looking for a place to sleep. I lost the path one day, and after that, followed nothing but the folds of the hills. I was going slowly down a slope to find the stream at the bottom in the early twilight, feeling my legs shake under me, when something came rushing at me from behind, and I felt my breath go out of me as the trees whirled around in a burst of light. Sometime after that, I was lying in a strange, strong-smelling bed of furs. Not far above my face was a ceiling, a low vault of raw black rock. It was almost dark. Beside me, something warm pressed against my leg, a big animal. It raised its head, a dog's long, gray, heavy head, grim black lips, dark eyes that gazed across me. It made a whining groan and got up and stepped over my legs. Someone spoke to it, then came and crouched down beside me. He spoke to me, but I didn't understand for a long time. I stared at him in the weak light that seemed to glance and reflect off the black rocks on the floor of the cave. I could see the whites of his eyes clearly and the gray-black hair that stuck out in shaggy clumps around his dark face. He smelled stronger than the dirty, half-cured furs of the bed. He brought me water in a cup made of bark and helped me drink, for I couldn't lift my head. Most of the time I lay in the low cave room, I had no memories of any other place or time. I was there, only there. I was alone, except when the dog was with me, lying by my left leg. Sometimes it raised its head and stared into the dark air. It never looked into my face. When the man came stooping into the room, the dog stood up and went to him, putting its long nose into his hand, and then went out. Later it would come back with him, or by itself, step over me, turn around once, and lie down by my leg. Its name was Guard. The man's name was Kuga, or Kuha. Sometimes he said one, sometimes the other. He talked strangely, deep in his throat, as if something obstructed his voice, which came out as if through rocks. When he came, he would sit down by me, give me fresh water, and offer me food, usually thin strips of smoke-dried meat or fish, sometimes a few berries as they came ripe. He never gave me much at a time.
"What were you doing then? Starving?" he said.
He talked a good deal when he was with me, and often I heard him in the other part of the cave talking to himself or to the dog, the same low, gargling, broken stream of words never waiting for an answer. To me, he said,
"What did you want to go starving for, anyhow? There's food. Food where you find it. What brought you up here? I thought you was from Darom. I thought they was after me again. I followed you, you know. I followed you and watched. I can watch all day. I told guard, lay low. You got up and I thought you was going on, but then you come straight down here, straight to my door. What am I to do, man? I'm behind you. I got my stick in hand. And so I hit you on the head, whack."
And he pantomimed a tremendous blow and laughed, showing his brown, wide-spaced teeth.
"You never knew I was there, did you? I killed him, I thought. I killed him. You went down like a dead branch. There you was. I killed him. So much for Darom. So then, I take a look, and it's a kid. Sampa. Sampa, I gone and killed a kid. No, not dead. Didn't even break his fool egg head, but he's down like a dead branch. A kid. I picked you up with one hand like a fawn. I'm strong, you know. They all know that. They don't come here. What did you come here for, boy? What brought you? What was you starving for? Lying there with 10,000 monies in your purse, bronzes, silvers, the faces of gods, rich as King Kumbelo. What was you starving for? What sort of place is this to come with all those monies? You going to buy deer from Lady Yenne? Are you crazy, boy? He nodded. You are. You are.
Then he chuckled again and said,
"So am I, boy. Crazy Kuga."
He chuckled again and gave me a sliver of sweet fibrous meat, bitter with smoke and ash. I slowly chewed at it, my mouth full of the juices of hunger. That was all there was for a while. My hunger, the vivid taste of the food he doled out to me, his broken voice talking, the black rock roof above my face, the reek of smoke and fur, the dog pressed against my leg. Then I could sit up. Then I could crawl to the entrance of the rock chamber and discover that it was the innermost, lowest one of several such chambers in the cave where Kugra had made his house. Slowly I explored them. In some you could stand up, at least in the center, and the largest room was quite spacious, though its floor was a jumble of big stones. The black rock of the cave was porous and cracked, and light came through cracks and crevices from above, making a smoky dimness. When I first went out, the sunlight blinded me with great, dazzling bursts of red and gold, and the air smelled sweet as honey. From outside the cave, even at its very entrance, you couldn't see it. Only a massive slant of rocks like a dry waterfall, all overgrown with creepers and ferns. Kuga's possessions were the deer skins and rabbit furs he had crudely cured, some bark cups, some spoons, and other implements he had whittled of alderwood, a roll of fine sinew, and his treasures, a metal box half full of dirty salt crystals, a tinderbox for fire-making, and two horn-handled hunter's knives of good steel, which he kept sharp on a fine-grained river pebble. Of these treasures he was fiercely jealous, suspicious of me, hiding them from me. I never knew where he kept the salt. The first time he had to bring out one of the knives where I could see it, he flourished it at me, snarling, and said in his choked voice, "Don't touch it. Don't touch it, or by the destroyer I'll cut out your heart with it." I won't touch it, I said.
It'll turn and cut your throat of itself if you do.
I never will.
You're a liar, he said. Liars. Men are liars.
Sometimes he would say a thing like that over and over, and would say nothing else all day. Men are liars, men are liars. Keep away, keep out, keep away, keep out. At other times, his talk was sane enough. I had little to say, and that seemed to suit him. He talked to me as he did to the dog, recounting his daily expeditions through the woods to his rabbit snares and fishing holes and berry patches, everything he had caught or seen or smelled or heard. I listened, just as the dog did, to those long tales, intently, not interrupting.
"You're a runaway,"
he said to me one evening as we sat out, looking up through the leaves at the heavy, bright stars of August.
"House slave, brought up soft. You run away. You think I'm a slave, don't you? Oh, no. Oh, no. You want runaways? You go on north, go on to the forest. That's where they are. I got nothing to do with them. Liars. Thieves. I'm a free man. I was born free. I don't want to mix with them, nor the farmers, nor the townsfolk. Sempa destroy them. Liars. Cheats. Thieves. All of them. Liars, cheats, thieves.
How do you know I'm a slave? I asked.
What else could you be?
He said with his dark grin and quick, canny look. I didn't know.
I come here to be free of them, all of them,
Kuga said.
They call me the wild man, the hermit. They're afraid of me. They leave me be, Kuga the hermit. They keep away. They keep out.
I said, you're the master of Kugamond. He sat for a while in silence, and then he broke out in his choked, chuckling laugh and slapped his thigh with his big, heavy hand. He was a big man and very strong, though he must have been 50 or more.
Say it again, he said.
You're the master of Kugamond.
That I am, that I am. This is my domain, and I'm the master here. By the destroyer, that's the truth. I met a man that speaks truth. By the destroyer, a man that speaks truth. He come here, and how do I welcome him? Smash his head in with a stick. How's that for a greeting? Welcome to Kugamond.
And he laughed for a long time. He would be silent and then laugh again and then again. At last he looked over at me through the gray starlight and said,
you're a free man here. Trust me.
I said, I trust you. Kuga lived in filth and never bathed, and his carelessly tanned hides and furs stank and rotted, but he was meticulous in preserving and storing food. He smoke-dried the meat of all the larger animals he caught, rabbits, hares, the occasional fawn, and hung it from the roof of the fireplace room of the cave. He set snares for the little creatures of the grasslands, too, wood rats, even harvest mice, and those he broiled on the fire and ate fresh. His snares were wonderfully clever, and his patience endless. But he had no luck with his hooks and lines, and seldom caught a fish big enough to be worth smoking. I could help him there. The sinew that was all he had for lines softened in the water. I pulled out some of the linen warp threads from the end of my brown blanket, and using them with the fine bone hooks he carved, I caught some big perch and bass, as well as the little brown trout that swarmed in the pools of the stream. He showed me how to dry and smoke the fish. Aside from that, I was of little use to him. He didn't want me with him on his expeditions. Often he ignored me entirely all day long, lost in his muttered repetitions. But when he ate, he always shared his food with me and with Guard. I never asked him why he'd taken me in and kept me alive. It didn't occur to me as a question. I never asked him any questions but one. I asked where Guard came from.
"Sheep dog bitch," he said. "Had her litter up over there east, on the rocky slopes. I seen the pups playing. Thought they was wolves, went over there with my knife to dig 'em out and cut their throats. I just got to the den, and the bitch come round the hill, and she was going to go for me. But I says, 'Hey, Nell. Hey there, mother. I'll kill a wolf, but never hurt a dog, will I?' And she shows her teeth."
He showed his brown teeth in a grinning snarl.
"And goes into the den. And so I go back and back, and we get to know each other, and she brings the pups out, and I watch 'em play. And this one and I got on. So he come away with me. I go back there sometimes. She's got a litter there now."
He never asked me any questions at all. If he had, I would have had no answers. When I found myself remembering anything, I turned away from it to whatever was under my eyes and in my hands, and lived in that only. I had none of the rememberings, the visions I used to have. If I dreamed in sleep, I didn't remember the dreams when I woke. The light in the mornings was more golden, the days ending sooner, the nights growing cool. The master of Kugamand, sitting across a small fire from me in the hearth room of his cave, slid a whole troutlet off the stick into his mouth, chewed a while, swallowed, wiped his hands on his naked dirt-caked chest, and said,
"Cold here in winter. You'd be dead of it."
I said nothing. He knew what he was talking about.
"You go on."
After a long time, I said, "Nowhere to go, Kuga?"
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The woods. That's where you go."
He nodded towards the north.
"The woods. Denaran. The big forest. No end to it, they say. And no slave takers there. Oh, no. No slave takers. Just the men of the woods. That's where to go."
"No roof," I said, and put another bit of bark on the fire.
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They live soft there. Roofs and walls and all. Beds and coats and all. They know me. I know them. We don't trouble each other. They know me. They keep away."
He scowled and went off into one of his mutterings, "Keep away, keep out." Next morning he shook me awake early. On the flat stone in front of the cave entrance, he set out my brown blanket, the silk purse swollen with money, a filthy fur cape he had given me a while ago, and a packet of dried meat.
"Come on," he said.
I stood still. His face went watchful and grim. "Keep this for me," I said, holding out the silk purse. He chewed his lip.
"Don't want to be killed for it, eh?"
he said finally, and I nodded.
"Maybe," he said. "Maybe they would. Thieves. Cheats. I don't want this stuff. Where'd I keep it from thieves?
In your salt box, I said. He glared. Where's that? He snapped, fiercely, suspicious. I shrugged again. I don't know. I never found it. Nobody could. That made him laugh, slowly, opening his mouth wide.
I know, he said. I know. All right.
The heavy, stained, discolored purse was swallowed up in his big hand. He went back into the cave with it and was gone some while. He came out and nodded at me.
Come on, he said,
and he set off at his loping walk that seemed slow but ate up the miles. I was fit again and could keep up with him all day, though by evening I was weary and footsore. At the last stream we came to, he told me to drink deep. We crossed it, climbed a long slope, and halted on the top of the hill, the last of the hills. From it the land fell slowly away into vast forest, treetops going on and on into blue dimness, no end to them. The sun hadn't set, but the shadows were long. Kuga was busy immediately. He gathered wood and built a fire, a large one, using green wood, not dry. The smoke went curling up into the clear sky.
All right, he said. They'll come.
And he turned to go back as we had come. Wait, I said. He stopped, impatient.
Just wait, he said. They'll be here.
I'll come back, Kuga. He shook his head angrily and went off, striding through the dry grass, holding his body in a slight crouch. In a minute, he was out of sight through the trees under the crest of the hill. Over the dark treetops, the sunset flamed. I slept alone by the fire on the hilltop that night, wrapped in my blanket and the fur cape. The smoky stink of the fur was pleasant to me. I had been healed in that stink. I waked again and again in the night. Once, I built up the fire, as a signal, not for warmth. Towards morning, I dreamed. I was sleeping in Sentos, in the fortress of dreams. The others were there with me. I heard their soft voices murmuring in the dark. One of the girls laughed. I woke and remembered the dream. I clung to it, trying to stay in it, but I was thirsty. Thirst had waked me. Telling myself I'd go look for water at the foot of the hill as soon as it was light, I lay waiting for the light. We never slept in Sentos, I thought. We always slept out near the farmhouse, under the trees. We always saw the stars through the leaves. We talked about going out to Sentos to sleep, but we never did.